This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. You know that feeling? A song comes on and instantly you're transported somewhere else entirely. Maybe back in the past or somewhere you've never even experienced. It happens to all of us. But what is that experience? And what can it tell us about how our minds work?
Dr. Elizabeth Helmuth-Margulis is our guest, and she is the professor of music at Princeton University, where she directs the Music Cognition Lab. Her new book, Transported, The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams, explores these musical reveries, arguing that our everyday listening experiences offer a powerful and underappreciated window into how we think and feel, with real implications for anxiety, creativity, and human connection. Dr. Margulis, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
I think it is just one of my favorite experiences when I haven't heard a song since my childhood. And it always happens with music by like Neil Diamond or Gordon Lightfoot, the people that my parents listened to when I was 6 years old. And not only does it transport me there, but somehow I can remember the lyrics. What is going on in a person's brain when this is happening?
So this is exactly what's so intriguing, is that the kind of memory that comes back tends not to feel kind of factual or distant, but really almost like a reliving. And it's that kind of, full throttle experience that I think is so fascinating. One of the things we know that's happening is that there's a reliable reminiscence bump for music from your own adolescence, where you tend to like it more even later in life and have more personal memories associated with it. But then there's, as you indicated in your comments, actually also a secondary reminiscence bump for music of your parents' adolescence. And what we think is going on there is that when you're a tiny person and you have no control over what's playing on the stereo, your parents tend to go back to their old favorites from their teenage years, and the cycle continues. As far as what's happening in your brain, we have seen, using neuroimaging, that the default mode network, which is precisely this part of your brain that comes online in a scanner when you aren't doing any kind of other task, where your mind wanders, you start thinking about your past and your future, that also snaps in and is active during music listening.
It's just a wonderful thing, and we respond to music. Some people respond to it much more than others, but there are those people who don't really listen to music, and I wonder what part of their brain is turned off.
So there's a really interesting instrument that's been developed in the field to measure these individual differences in musicality. It's called the Goldsmith's Musical Sophistication Index. And what's interesting there is that people vary not only along things like how much formal training they have or like how good they are at singing, right? Like how on pitch their voice is or something, but also in basic things like how many music seeking behaviors they tend to have, how engaged you are by music. Like, do you curate custom made playlists and get really excited about it and go to concerts, or is that not such a big part of your life? And one of the things that we think is happening there has to do with just connections between the auditory system and the reward system. And we know this from studying musical anhedonics. So that is people who can process music perfectly well, but don't derive any pleasure from it.
Huh. Well, I can process music perfectly well. I just can't carry a tune. Hey, Lynn, interesting that, you know, you brought up Gordon Lightfoot, because there's that wonderful lyric, "If I could read your mind, babe," which is going to come right into my next question here. Dr. Margulis, how did you come to focus your research on musical daydreams specifically? Were you listening to something, a piece of music when you realized, hey, this everyday experience was really cool and maybe even scientifically specific or significant?
It was really my students who led me down this path, because I was brainwashed as a conservatory student of piano. So I was trained super classically. I would not have known a daydream if it hit me in the face, right? I was like all concerned with things about, you know, notes and highly technical things. And it wasn't until my students started reporting their experiences imagining vivid scenes while listening that they did that enough times that I started to get really intrigued and curious and realized that I had actually become disconnected from an important part of musical listening myself. And that set me down this whole research agenda that I've been on for the past 10 years or so.
That's fascinating. I mean, this is something that came to you a little bit later then.
Exactly. I was a late bloomer. And, you know, it did then, once I went down this path, I started thinking about my earliest experiences. So one of my very first musical experiences that I can remember, my parents took me, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. They took me to Powell Symphony Hall to hear Handel's Messiah. And I didn't know that it's tradition for people to stand during the Hallelujah chorus. What I thought was happening was that people were just so overwhelmed and moved by what they were hearing that they spontaneously rose out of their seats. And that was an initial kind of hook for me about how powerful music can feel. And once I sort of returned to thinking about those experiences, I realized that, you know, my origins were in experiencing music that way.
So you came to this a little bit later. How would you actually describe a musical daydream? How is it different from just enjoying a song?
My favorite example, it's the one I use to open the book, comes from the final scene of the movie La La Land, where, and let me just, you know, paint the picture for you a bit. If you remember, the character played by Emma Stone had this whirlwind romance with the character played by Ryan Gosling. And by the end, that didn't work. They've moved on. It's later in their lives. She's happily married, stumbles into a jazz bar, and it turns out to be his place, right? And he comes to the front. He starts playing a song. It's the song he was playing when they first met. And then we as an audience watch everything fade to black. And we re-enter that first encounter with her. We like remember everything about it. And then we go with her on this whole fantasy of what it could have been if things had worked out. The song ends, the fantasy crumbles. We're back in this bar in the present day. So that's exactly what I mean by kind of going on this ride where, you know, it's prompted by the music, but you're really lost in some other kind of place while you're listening.
You've reminded me what a great film that was.
It really is a special movie. You know, it's come back around. My teenagers got so obsessed with La La Land that they were like going to live orchestra performances accompanying the movie with their friends. Yeah. Having a moment.
I love that. Oh my gosh. I wanted to ask you about how we sort of view music and engage in music and ritual across cultures, because it is ubiquitous, and yet we don't have to have music. We don't need it for survival, or I don't know, do we?
So this is exactly what I think is so intriguing about music, is the fact that it is, as you mentioned, globally ubiquitous. There's no known human culture that doesn't do something that we think about as music, but also so intriguingly variable. So it really points to the way that we have to have models that help us think about biology and culture within one framework. It's not enough to have some sort of like, if you put in these notes, this response will come out, right? Because it's mediated by all kinds of life experiences and enculturation and so forth. But at the same time, there's this deep shared kind of biological resonance. So I think part of where the field has gone in the last 20 years that's so exciting is really handling that variability in really cool, sophisticated ways.
And then sort of related to this, I love to talk about language. And I have often wondered when, I especially think of Icelandic bands, they're always singing in English. And I think, I mean, obviously English is their second language and it's a part of them. But I wonder somehow if you're not singing in your native language, if that is doing something to upset something in your psyche or your cognition. What do you think about that?
So, you know what's really interesting about lyrics and music is that it's a really stable trait level individual characteristic, whether or not you pay attention to lyrics at all. So some percentage of people really know all the words.
Mm-hmm.
Other parts of the society, like myself, I can listen to a song 8 million times. I don't even know what the chorus is saying, right? Like I just am not listening to the lyrics. And if you're like not a lyric listener today, you tend to also be not a lyric listener 5 years from now and 10 years before now. So I think it really depends, right? How central that lyric piece is in, you know, both your listening habit and in the art form, right? So someone like Leonard Cohen or, you know, I don't know, Bob Dylan, right? The lyrics are huge. And you can imagine lots of other musical styles where it's, you know, a little incidental.
Yeah. That's so funny because it makes me think of when we take a chorus, take the lyrics, and we shape it into something we think it's saying, and then we sing it like that along with the music, but it's saying something completely differently. And I remember someone approaching my husband from another country saying, oh, I love that song, Rain Rimsky, Red Rimsky. And my husband saying, I don't know that song, you know. And he's, you know, Red Rimsky. He was talking about raindrops keep falling on my head. Red Rimsky.
Amazing. There's actually, I forgot the URL, but there's an incredible internet archive of misheard lyrics where you can find a number of real gems.
You know, Lynn, you're talking about the Icelandic bands that sing in English. What's interesting, if you ever notice, even the British bands, when they sing, they lose their accent, which is, I think, kind of interesting and kind of cool. And just by the way, Dr. Margulis, when they do let me alone in the studio from time to time to DJ here at KPCW, I actually will do an entire set of misheard lyrics.
Oh, that's so excellent.
You'd want to know the lyrics I have misheard. Let's turn this back around a little bit more to the science side of this. I'm curious, what do you think is actually happening in the brain during one of these experiences? What does neuroscience show us? Are we using PET scans or some kind of MRI to map the brain when we are daydreaming during songs?
Yes, absolutely. So let me start with one cool study that was conducted by a graduate student here, Jamal Williams, where he put people in an MRI scanner and he showed them the entire movie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. But he showed it in one of two versions, either the original version or a version where the soundtrack had been taken out, but all the sound effects and dialogue were preserved. And so then through clever analysis, he could show that only in the case when people were listening to the original version with the soundtrack were brain representations of earlier scenes reactivated later when those tunes came back on later scenes. So the music's really choreographing as you're watching which prior scenes are relevant and should be reactivated in memory, even outside conscious awareness. So that's one interesting piece. And then another study that we ran in our lab leveraged the fact that we know that we can play people new excerpts of music they've never heard before. And because of all this behavioral work we've done, see that even when they think they're having a very idiosyncratic daydream, so you just ask them to report what they imagined, they end up telling you pretty much the same thing for individual excerpts. So we know for excerpt X, if we put you in the scanner and we play you it, we know what you're likely to imagine in your head. And so we could bring people in and do that, or we could play them spoken versions of these stories we knew they were likely to imagine. And then we could compare the brain activity. And what we can see there is really distinct activation patterns in the default mode on a per excerpt basis. So we can just sort of like see the story that goes with a particular excerpt crystallizing in a participant's mind.
Do different types of music then, tempo, key, lyrics versus something, you know, just lyrics, produce different kinds of daydreams, you think?
One of the things we saw that was pretty interesting compared to other designs in the scanner where people have imagined stories is a lot of visual activity. So this part of musical imaginings where you're really picturing things in quite a vivid way seems to be important, which is interesting because there's a whole population of people you might have heard about, aphantasics, who do not generate visual imagery in the mind's eye in the way that most of us do. So one interesting line of work is looking at these music-evoked imaginings in people that don't generate visual mental imagery.
What is the name again for the person who doesn't generate visual?
So it's aphantasia. So being without that kind of, there's a kind of a flip side situation where you can have hyperphantasia, which is, you know, really, really florid and omnipresent kind of imaginings.
And so would those people with hyper be the people that get absolutely swept away with emotion when they hear a certain song? It could be one bar. It could be four notes from a song and they just get swept away.
Exactly. You're hitting the nail on the head that we think that part of what's powerful about ordinary musical listening really goes through these imagined scenes. So it's not just kind of sound and emotional response. It's sound transportation to some imagined, you know, scene or memory, and that that is part of this whole emotional experience.
Wow. That's crazy. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Elizabeth Margulis. She's a professor of music at Princeton University, where she directs the Music Cognition Lab. And we're talking to her today about her new book, Transported, The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. This is such a fun topic.
Writing the book was kind of a blast because unlike the scholarly literature that I'm normally writing, right? This was an opportunity to really take readers on the most fun journey through these topics. And there's so many kind of wild entanglements between this topic and other kinds of facets of life that I had a really great time writing.
Oh, good. Well, we are always looking for ways that we can improve our mental health. And I know that, I mean, I've heard a lot of things about, you know, we've done interviews on art therapy and how that works, but music therapy, I mean, I know that you mentioned in your book possible ways to help with anxiety and then these positive things like increase your creativity and things like that. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about music therapy?
Yes, absolutely. So one thing is that if we know that music can transport you to some other kind of thoughtscape than the one you're in, then we know that lots of disorders where one of the symptoms are stuck thoughts or some kind of negative pattern of rumination like anxiety and like depression, it's a really low barrier to entry intervention to press play on a song and kind of be jump-started into a different mental landscape. And I think that's something we do quite intuitively, right? We use music for mood regulation, you know, all the time. But then there are other potential applications. For example, there's some evidence that even into early and middle stage dementia, that music can continue to elicit preserved memories, even when other cues have already failed. And so that's another really interesting potential application. But there are also already lots of practices in current music therapy in the clinical world now that take advantage of music's capacity to cue imagery as the baseline for various kinds of therapies.
Is this kind of therapy universal, or are there cultural differences in how people experience musical daydreams, or is it kind of universal?
This is a great question. And what we have seen in the cross-cultural work we've done is that what has remained the same in all the places we've studied is that music does cue vivid daydreams, and those daydreams tend to be shared within particular pieces of music or songs for people within a culture, but then that doesn't translate across culture. So that means that these practices have to be mindful of the kind of you know, way that music works in that place and the kinds of things that are meaningful to people, rather than kind of one, you know, prescription where, you know, take this playlist and call me in the morning, right? It's a little more individually tailored than that.
I love it. You can prescribe music on different genres, I guess. Your research also collects people's free response descriptions of their listening experiences. What's some of the more surprising things people report?
Yes. So one thing that I found really striking is some of these cross-cultural differences. So I'll give you an example. We had one excerpt where when we studied people in the U.S., people just person after person told us, this sounds like there's someone alone in a house getting stalked by a murderer. That's terrible. And we played the same exact excerpt for people in a rural village in China where they speak Dong and have very little exposure to Western media. And there, people also had a very strong reaction and individually tend to imagine something that was the same as other people in this village. But it was not something dangerous. It was, in fact, having fun outside, playing games with friends. So what this provided was a really interesting way to listen to an excerpt and try to get behind someone's ears and think about how it would be possible to hear it in this really different way. And that practice was so kind of generative and in kind of building understanding that I ended up bringing it home and using it a lot with my parents, using it with my teenagers, where it's just an incredible provocation for conversation to put in a song and talk about it, what it brings to your mind, and talk about it, what it brings to someone in a different generation's mind. And we had just many long car rides where this really carried us through, and we had a blast.
That is what a great, sitting around the table activity to do instead of some of the other things we do, you know,
yes,
table.
Yes, and I think you'll find both the connections where you're imagining the same thing and you can't figure out why that's happening. That's surprising and interesting. And then also these divergences are also quite fascinating as well.
Right, right. What do scientists still not understand about music? Is there some part of it that is still a mystery to scientists?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's really fun in my field is that the science is constantly following the artistic practice. So constantly musicians are doing cool things and it's raising new questions that are, you know, generating new paradigms in science. I mean, maybe just to take an example, things like improvisation, like and especially in groups, how people play together, how they're communicating non-verbally and staying in sync and playing with each other's ideas. And, you know, one of the new approaches that's being used there is hyperscanning, where you have different musicians that are in brain scanners, right, in MRI scanners all at the same time, where you're able to scan them as they interact. So, those kinds of designs. There's also cool new labs where all the seats are wired up to collect, you know, physiological information and behavioral responses from people that are live at concerts. So there's all kinds of exciting new directions.
That's really cool. I mean, I'm wondering if I've ever sat in one of those seats.
Well, I was going to say the two kind of leading labs there. There's one in Hamilton, Ontario at McMaster University, and one in Frankfurt, Germany at a Max Planck Institute. So those are the places you're likeliest to have, you know, had EEG caps thrust upon you while you were innocently attending a concert.
Looking forward to that experience. For someone who really wants to be more intentional about their relationship with music, just as you were kind of giving the example of you and your family.
Yes.
As a jumping off space for either car rides or dinner conversations. What do you think is one thing your research suggests that they could do differently if they really want to alter their relationship with music?
I think it's taking some of these experiences that we tend to discount as, you know, mind wandering or a distracted mind, and realizing that actually where our mind goes to has a lot to teach us about ourselves, who we are, how we come to make sense of our lives, the communities we're a part of. So not only for self-insight, but also for these kinds of conversations. So my suggestion would be not to view these as my conservatory trained self might have initially, as, you know, some kind of failure to pay attention, but actually look at them for what they are, which is a very innate capacity to derive meaning from sound.
Very cool. Very cool. Dr. Margulis, thank you so much for sharing these stories with us on Cool Science Radio today. I could tell you, I think we could go on for another hour. This is absolutely fascinating. I got to figure out how to get out of my own head sometimes. Every time I hear Blackwater by the Doobie Brothers, I'm transported back to when I was a fry cook at a very famous popular fried chicken chain. And the end of the night, my manager would always put this song on while I was cleaning the fryers. And to this day, when I hear that song, I can smell the oil that I'm changing in the fryers. It's just absolutely wild. So I know there must be a connection there. It's just, now I'm going to really dig deep into your book, which is really fascinating.
Just as soon as I leave, I'm going to turn on that song and see if I can smell some.
Oh, please make sure I'm not listening. But thank you so much for being on Cool Science Radio today.
I appreciate your time so much. Thank you.